Good morning and welcome to this last day of September of 2014. My name is Bruce Stocking.
And I'm Corinne Lillis.
And you are listening to a special edition of It's a New Day. It's our special education roundtable that'll take place today. 2 hours of talking various things such as the history of education, Common Core and legislation, and options such as, and this will be in our second hour, which will be Christian schools, charter schools, cyber schools, and homeschooling. So we have 2 hours filled with information that you need to know concerning the education of our young folks out there, our future generations, and to see that the guidance is there, get parents involved once again, identify where our problems are and what direction we need to go.
But, and that's why we have this pomp and circumstance graduation walk march music in the background.
Yes, when we're all done, we get a diploma.
It feels like it's May or June.
Yes. Well, let's start things off, Corinne, with a verse.
We do have a verse. This one is from Isaiah. It is chapter 28, verse 29. And it's perfect for today for this education roundtable here on 1180 AM WFYL. And it reads, "The Lord of Heaven's armies is a wonderful teacher."
Yes.
And I don't think that can be stressed enough. The best teacher is our Heavenly Father, and he knows all. He knows every single thing, every detail about your life, and he wants to teach you. He is the great creator. So when in doubt of where you should go for knowledge, I think it's pretty easy to assume that the Lord of Heaven's armies would be that wonderful teacher.
Yes, indeed. And that leads into a little bit of the history in which I want to relate about education and schooling. Now, we were to be joined by Paul Fisher, headmaster of the Coventry Christian School in Pottstown, but unfortunately there is some illness over in the school that he has to attend to and cannot break away, and we wish all the best for him and for the school.
Yes.
But let's talk about the history of education. Education has been something that goes far before any governments, any structure of such, and it went right down to, well, we can say the parents, the elders, mm-hmm. where they would share their life experience and knowledge with the younger generations. And as time went on, and of course here in the United States, education becomes a key component. Now, the key factor to education in the early days, as it should be today, is the parents. There was no such thing as really school when the country started off. Is the parents themselves would teach the children. The mother would teach her daughters the home arts and cooking, mending, tending to the small animals in the farmyard, various other lessons taught. The father would teach the son farming or a trade that the father had, but both parents together on Sundays would take the children with them and they would go to church. Church in those days was not an hour or two activity on a Sunday. It was an all-day activity. The parents would go to church itself, but the young folks would go to a smaller area, room, and would have school. And at this school, they would learn what would be the education fundamentals, which is to read the Bible, to be able to write about the Bible. It was Bible studies. This is where our term Sunday school comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Pennsylvania, and this man basically set the formula, the format for education. He was a Mennonite. His name was Christopher Dock. Christopher Dock was a minister, but he was an educator. And he was in the lower Salford area of Pennsylvania, which is Harleysville, the Salford Township throughout there. And he would travel to various locations to teach school. One place that he taught consistently was in a little schoolhouse that sat on the property, which is now the Lower Skipack Mennonite Church. There's a graveyard there. And in that graveyard was a small building. Now, Christopher Dock did live not far from there, up towards Soderton. But he would spend long periods of time at one particular school. And every night, every morning and every night, he would pray to God for his children that he educated. His education that he taught was biblical. The Bible, reading the Bible, understanding the Bible, writing about the Bible. And he wrote down rules for education. The proper way to sit, the proper way to address, morals, values, respect, all those basic principles, plus, as we used to call them, the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, would come later. And he was so dedicated that, as the story with Christopher Dock goes, they hadn't seen him for a while. All during the day, they hadn't seen him. So they went to the school. The school wasn't open that day. So they went to the school that was located at the Lower Skipback Mennonite Church. And they went into the school, and they found Christopher Dock kneeling at his bedside, his hands clasped in prayer. And he was dead. He died in prayer, praying for his students, always for guidance to instruct his students, always praying for them that they would learn and appreciate. The schoolhouse that he taught is no longer there. But Christopher Dock is buried in the graveyard where the school once stood. A little history.
Interesting.
On education. And the basics for education came down to, it was the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is some of the things we're going to talk about today. And of course, today, our first topic that we're going to deal with is something that's going on here in Pennsylvania, which is Common Core. Common Core, a lot has been talked about it, and on the phone lines with us is one of our contributors to today's program, Cheryl Boyce, Pittsburgh Director and Research of the Commonwealth Education Association, advisor to the Pennsylvania Against Common Core. Cheryl, welcome to the program. And we're just waiting a little problem in there.
Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Ah, there she is.
Good morning.
Good morning. Of course, if you've heard our intro, we were talking a little bit about the basis, how schooling came about. But now that schooling that we've dealt with, we've all come through in our youth and through school, is being, well, what I like to call it, it's being threatened, being changed. And it's called Common Core. And if you could give us a little introduction, Cheryl, on what exactly you do and on Common Core.
All right. First of all, my name is Cheryl Boyce. I have years of experience in preschool, so I know a little bit about what it's like to teach children. As the director of an organization called Commonwealth Education Organization in Pittsburgh, we were asked, because we did a lot of educational research, we were asked by a group of folks 2 years ago to help create an organization called Pennsylvania's Against Common Core. As an advisor of that group, I've been working with them since then. I've testified in front of the Senate Education Committee about Common Core in Pennsylvania and the problems with that. So we have a lot of research behind us, and a lot of people don't understand what is significant about Common Core. First of all, we had standards, we had testing, we had the PSSA test that was implemented in 1999, and we had a lot of discussion about this as a state. There were a lot of hearings. And the House Education Committee went across the state and got input about that. That was the first top-down approach to standards. Standards drive the curriculum, and when the standards are in the test, it really drives the curriculum or what kids are learning in the classroom. Well, in 2009, the state decided to start implementing a new test called the Keystone, which is a graduation test. And around the same time, we started hearing and started investigating and researching a program called Common Core. Now, what that is really top-down. That is a national program.
Mm-hmm.
It was, a lot of people say the states were involved because the Governor Association was involved. That's really a trade organization. That is not the same thing as states actually doing their own standards like we had in 1999. We had people like David Coleman, who's now the head of the college boards. He is one of the major architects of the actual Common Core standards. David Coleman has never taught in a classroom in any form, from pre-K through college. He has no background as far as writing standards or curriculum. That is not his forte. So we have a lot of people like David Coleman involved with this initiative.
Shirley, if I could ask you, if an individual such as the gentleman you just mentioned has no education background whatsoever, how could he be such involved in creating something of an education value?
That is our question. Parents ask me that all the time. That's a legitimate question. He was part of a think tank. Now, you have to realize they all sit around a room, have coffee and lunch, and they decide how they think things should go. This was really set up, to be honest with you, since we've had so many federal programs, national programs. We've had, you know, outcome-based education, Goals 2000, No Child Left Behind. So these people sort of slid in under all of those things and said, let's do this nationally. He went to Bill Gates. Bill Gates has spent $200 million to promote this across the country.
Now, if I can jump in there, Bill Gates is involved because through Microsoft that there are different types of curriculum that go with that that can be displayed at Microsoft. So it's a profit thing for Gates, correct?
Yes. He's spent $200 million, but the projection is he's going to get all of that money back plus more. Plus more. So, yeah, he's not as altruistic as everybody thinks he is. There is an objective behind that. He isn't big into data collection. He thinks education should be run sort of like Microsoft, like a business. That's the whole premise of this. So they come together, and then to the third part of this is the federal government, because the states agreed to all of this based on the money the federal government was going to ante up through the stimulus and then a competitive grant program called Race to the Top. And the states had to apply, and they had to agree with any kind of grant thing. You have to agree to certain provisions, and the standards and testing and all that was part of the Race to the Top. Now, we agreed to do this and get the Race to the Top money and wanted that money before we even saw the standards in Pennsylvania. They were not even written when we started to agree to do these things.
Oh, I could sell you a bridge in Brooklyn that way, too.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
But it comes down to, again, it's the money thing, and
yes,
which we hear quite often, federal money, which is our money, by the way,
right,
being used to bribe the public. It becomes to the states a narcotic, in a sense. Am I correct?
Yes, yes. And the funny thing is, it's called an underfunded mandate. What we did is we applied under, now we've had two governors, five secretaries of ed during this whole process. Under Rendell, we applied and we were rejected. Under Corbett, we reapplied for Race Top and got it this time. We received $43 million. But the problem is, the projections are way beyond $43 million. We haven't even got a good handle on that because the Senate did have comprehensive hearings and they asked the State Board of Education and Department of Ed here in Harrisburg, well, exactly how much is it going to cost? And then they couldn't tell us. They said it was cost neutral. No, it's not.
Yeah.
So we've got $43 million from the federal government, not knowing really in bottom line what it's going to cost the districts or the state to implement this.
Well, as we all know, when it deals with federal money and any projection of how much something's going to cost, they lowball it every time we end up spending 10 times more than what we should.
Always, always, always. But the big thing people have to understand, it's not just the process by which we got the standards. Doing research, part of the problem is the quality. Nobody talks about the quality of the standards.
Yeah.
They are not appropriate for early learners. There are a lot of problems in the elementary grades because you're asking kids to do things that they're not cognitively developed enough to do. Math is a big one.
Yeah, I saw that, and my question would be, what's the point of that? I mean, people don't give birth to full-grown adults. Is that there's a progression of learning and developing that goes on there, and it's like, oh, nuts to that, we're going to jump right to the top.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's what they did. They used the premise that we want kids to be college and workforce ready. There was a concept, and there is a concept called school to work, and some countries use that. China uses it, Germany, where education is for the workforce from a very early age. So fundamentally, that's one of the things. You've got organizations like National Center for Education and Economy and Mark Tucker, outcome-based education, and now he's involved with Common Core. So that's their philosophy. So you're gearing kids towards the workforce instead of them learning from a very early age. But it's fundamentally flawed because all the research and all the experts will tell you kids at 7 years old can't do what they're asking them to do,
right.
The average student.
Right.
Can't do it.
So, Cheryl, would you say that we're trying to copy this whole idea of being more like China in the way that we want to do education?
I think that's... There are people, I think there's a lot of factions involved with Common Core. There is that faction that's looking at it from a workforce college readiness perspective. But the flaw in this whole thing is we're not doing it correctly to give the early learners a foundation and they're asked to do things they shouldn't do. But at the high school level, the standards are written to the minimum. So it's not at all what it should be. At high school, the standards should be written to the top. We should be writing standards to Tier 1 colleges. Kids should be able to get into Harvard and Yale from those standards. But those are lower expectations at the high school level, so it's flipped. But that's what happens when you have people write standards that don't know anything about learning, don't know anything about curriculum, and don't know anything about kids.
Right. And I also have seen in a lot of different things with this, let's just say in the fact of history, that it's been so misinterpreted, misleading, and in some cases degrades history as well. Political cause there?
Yes. There's no debate that in education, politics and philosophy, adults' philosophy drives the agenda. That's true in Harrisburg. That's true in Washington. There is a political agenda for all of this. And a lot of people, there's no one philosophy, I think, that drives this. You see multiple philosophies coming together over the years, and that's merged with Common Core.
Now,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Finish your thought.
I think it's just really an issue of you have to look at who the person is. Bill Gates, his motivation is different than David Coleman. David Coleman is a social justice person. Mm-hmm. So their motivation is very different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Cheryl, I know that we've only got you for a few more minutes, but also on our phone lines is Dawn Sweeney, who is a mother and a teacher. And she's going to join in our conversation with Common Core testing and the effects of on public homeschooling and special education. Dawn, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Good morning.
And we've been talking with Cheryl about the Common Core. I don't know how much you've been listening in on what we have to say, but we're talking about the standards that she put out that they're trying to give too much to the younger children, such as math and so forth. And then we got to the point of history where it's more of a political spin to try to rewrite history. Nat, your thoughts on that along with Cheryl?
Well, I agree with everything Cheryl has said thus far. It's clearly developmentally not appropriate for the younger kids. Special ed kids are now expected to take these tests on their grade level when all year they've been working with their IEPs and adaptations. Then all of a sudden it comes to test time, and even if they're working on a fourth grade level all year, they have to take the sixth grade test. Many times without the adaptations that they've been using throughout the entire school year.
Now, a question comes to mind, Cheryl, you as well, is, you know, to expect on a test someone to take a test at a level higher than what they're having. I understand the workforce, you always try to work at the next level above what you currently have. But with children, you can't do that. And so isn't that going to increase a fail rating?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. But, Dawn, I don't want to step on you. There's a distinct difference between a testing and assessment. A test is historically what we had, and that was used as a tool to determine how children learned and mastered material. That's what we were all used to. An assessment is a political and a government tool to judge the system. And what you're saying is assessment. So the value to the student and the parents, which Dawn is going to address, is very different with a test that we're used to, like the old achievement test and old classroom test, as opposed to an assessment that we have today. The motivation is different.
Yeah. Dawn?
Well, one thing I want to share, and I think this is very important, is the amount of time now that students are spending doing assessments. For example, I have a daughter in 10th grade and I have a daughter in 8th grade. This week, my kids have been in school for 19 days, and this week, two days for my 8th grader, who's in algebra, will be spent on test prep and assessments. So that's lost instructional time. They'll have 3 days of regular classes, 2 days of assessments. And this occurs throughout the year. When my older daughter took algebra, we sort of tracked how much time she spent on Keystone test prep, and she could clearly identify which was, she called it regular math and Keystone math for algebra. And 2 full weeks prior to the testing was spent on test prep. But throughout the year, we tallied at least 20% of classroom time in her algebra class was spent in test prep for the Keystones. Now, I called a couple college admissions, because these Keystones are graduation requirements, and I asked them how much weight do they put on these Keystone exams. My daughter's going to be a junior next year. I'm looking into colleges. Zero. They don't recognize or consider the Keystones exams in any capacity.
Why is that?
I don't know. That's a very good question.
Yeah.
You know, but they, college admissions consider GPA, they consider SAT or ACT scores, mm-hmm. Academic portfolios, extracurriculars. They do not consider the Keystone exams in any capacity. So our kids are spending as much as 20% in a class. For 3 classes, for algebra, biology, and literature, test prepping and taking this test, and it has no bearing on their college admissions.
Okay.
You know, and students have to do well on the SATs in order to get into a college of their choice, so you're taking time away from that. You're taking time away from preparing, building up your GPA, and then it exponentially gets worse, because if a student doesn't pass a Keystone, they then have to take a remedial course. So this year, students were being pulled out of geometry or elective classes, sophomores, to take a remedial class to prepare them for the next retest of their algebra Keystone.
Cheryl, I know you're on a limited time. We're going to have to let
yes,
you go pretty
I know.
Soon. But
do you have
a quick comment about the Keystone, the question of why don't they accept it?
Yeah, it's very simple. If you look at the colleges and universities, the Keystone is unique to Pennsylvania. All of the states were required to have their own individual testing associated with Common Core, and it's ours is the Keystone. But if we want international students coming into our universities, which happens like at Penn State, they don't have that test. So in order to have a common ground, the kids will take the ACT and the SAT coming from California, if they're coming to Pennsylvania to go to Penn State, or coming from India to go to Penn State. So that test has no value.
I understand.
As far as the university goes. There's no value to that. It is an administrative tool in Pennsylvania to judge the schools, and now will be used to judge the teachers and the principal's performance.
Mm. Yeah, and that kind of gives me the impression with a lot of testing, it's kind of like an employer doing an evaluation on another employee.
Right.
It actually reflects on the supervisor and the job they're doing if the employee passes
right.
or fail.
Right, exactly.
Cheryl, it's been great. I'm glad
right.
you spent some time with us.
Thank you.
The best to you, and keep up
Thank
the fight.
You. Thank you very much.
All
Bye-bye.
Right, thanks. Okay, we were just listening to
Cheryl Boyce,
who's with the Pittsburgh Director and Research Commonwealth Education Association. We're still on the line right now with Dawn Sweeney. Dawn,
yes.
With what she was saying, does that make sense to you with what we're talking about?
And yes, it does.
So, but it makes it tough for you then.
Well, you know, as a parent, my child, and this goes for all students in Pennsylvania, they're not, they're missing out on true instructional time, and they're missing out on the opportunity to improve their GPA.
Right.
So it is frustrating. And it's frustrating for the students. I mean, these are 15 and 16-year-old kids. And if essentially your 12 years of education come down to a 90-minute test.
Yeah. I mean, why not just take the test and, you know, the 12 years do something else?
Yeah. Now, in Pennsylvania, parents do have the option to opt out of the PSSAs and the Keystone exams.
Mm-hmm.
For religious reasons, however, you do not need to state what your religious reason is. So it's a simple opt-out procedure that many parents do not know about.
Right. Well, you know, when you look at that and you know the religious opt-out and they're not asking anything about it, you know, my mind tends to go to what I call the Unaffordable Care Act, for example, where you're starting to do that and all the machinations that they're trying to do with that. Wouldn't they then just turn if you wanted to use that and do the same? Is it, you know, your thoughts on that?
As far as medical care?
With the religious beliefs.
Well, it's very specific in that you can opt out of state assessments. You can't opt out of every assessment.
Okay.
But as it relates to health care and stuff, I feel like this Common Core is on the same level as far as giving everyone an average or to below average option as far as education.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, Dawn joining us on the line right now is Lisa Esler. Lisa, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And, of course, Lisa's calling. She'll talk a little bit about Common Core as well, the impact on the public school. And, Lisa, I have to tell you right off the bat, I read the letter that you had published that dealt with Common Core and to the Times. And I've got to tell you, you've nailed every point. And maybe you can elaborate a little bit with our listeners some of the points that you brought out in that letter, because it's excellent.
Thank you. Well, first of all, let me tell you, I am a school board director in Pennsylvania, but I don't speak for the board. However, our board did pass a resolution, one of the few, against Common Core in Pennsylvania. So I give them credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to write a letter that kind of spoke to every aspect, but in a simplistic way, so that parents could understand it, because I think parents are very frustrated now, and it's hard to get your head around Common Core.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an educator, but I see as a parent and a grandparent and a school board director that people are alarmed, but they don't know what to do because they don't know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I wrote the letter.
Ah. And, you know, the points that you bring out in there with the fact of, the federal money being used on this, and basically you're pointing out the whole thing's a bamboozle, which is exactly right. You point out how it was accepted without being read, and now Corbett's having it looked into. So, and Dawn, you're still on the line with us.
I am, yes.
Did you get a chance to read her letter at all?
I did not.
Okay, it's just a fantastic piece. And
I would love to read it.
And is it available online, Lisa?
I believe you can pull it up under the Delco Times.
Okay.
And using my name.
Right.
Yes.
Strongly suggest on that. Now, with some of the other effects as a, the Penn Delco board member, and that the decision process you went through with them to say, no way we're going to play with this thing.
It took me a year to actually educate the board and had a few changes during the election to actually get this done. So they weren't on board to begin with. And I just think that people are now starting to hear from parents more. The parents are frustrated. And I just look at the simple things. I mean, like I said, I'm not an educator.
Mm-hmm.
I learned in school. I graduated in 1980. I learned everything I needed, the foundation and what I needed to get through to become a successful adult.
Right.
And I just don't understand why that had to change. As soon as the Department of Education entered the picture, the federal government, things started to change in education.
Yeah.
And that was the beginning of the downfall, and I believe we're now at an educational crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And parents need to recognize it, superintendents and teachers need to recognize it. And I just ask that they speak out, because one of the things that really bothers me is I can't get parents to the board meetings.
Yeah.
Parents are afraid to say anything because they're afraid it might come back on their child. And they need to group together, and they need to speak at these board meetings. They need to call the Department of Education. They need to call Governor Corbett's office.
Yeah, who by the way, and folks don't realize this due to all the negative ads that have been going on him, he is against Common Core. Totally against Common Core on this one. And so I just wanted to inject that in there as well to clarify for folks.
Lisa, I have a question for you. What do you think is the most important thing that parents need to know about Common Core? For those who don't know much about it, what's the most important thing that they need to be aware of?
I think there's several aspects. Number one, that they're collecting information that's going to the state that they don't know about. I think that's really important. I think another thing is that they're putting a lot of pressure on kids, and I think sometimes parents leave it in the educators' hands to know what is best.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that most of the good teachers now are leaving. My sister's a teacher. The teachers that are coming in now are just kind of complying instead of utilizing what they learned in their education to bring out in the best in the children. And they're just kind of going along to get along. And the children are the ones that are suffering and are frustrated.
Yeah.
I heard a superintendent once say about the testing, well, if we don't teach to the test, they won't pass. And I said, that's a really scary thing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's the mentality today of educators, and I'm not sure why.
Yeah, well, Dawn Sweeney's still on the line with us.
Yes.
You're a mom and a teacher. Your thoughts on this?
I am involved with many teachers across Pennsylvania and nationally. And the teachers that I'm involved with, I mean, it's in the many thousands, are opposed to Common Core. And they are afraid to speak out against it because, number one, their evaluations are based on these test scores in part. But they're just afraid they're going to lose their jobs. In my school district, my superintendent, my assistant superintendent, my kids' teachers, I email all of them. And they're very supportive of my kids. They're very supportive of me. They appreciate my emails, my letters to the editor. But that's where it ends.
Yeah.
They have to follow the rules of the state and the federal, USDOE, and their hands are tied. But I have yet to meet a teacher that is okay with what's happening with Common Core. Yeah. The teachers are not okay.
Yeah, because it kind of, Lisa, and this you can elaborate on this as well. It does manacle a good teacher.
Sure, and. You know, I go back, I keep thinking about what really works. And if they really wanted to improve education, what would they have done? Well, I would have taken the best of the best across the state. And I would have somehow incorporated that into a program. But they didn't. They sat around and they thought they knew what was best. And they ignored best practices across the state, which are the laboratories of innovation. And that, to me, is alarming, and it should be a red flag to anybody that's looking at the Common Core standards.
That's
best practices.
The educator, this is not promoted by educators. This is not promoted by folks who have a background in education. These folks haven't taught in classrooms, and they don't have an educational background, yet they are mandating our educational standards. And I think a big reason to one thing that Lisa had said is the data collection. And what better way to have uniform standards and uniform data collection than to have every state in the country use the same standards? It makes it much easier for the data collection.
Well,
one thing I want to point out, too, is that along those lines is that if you talk to any superintendent or teacher today, they spend more time collecting data on the children, whether it be on their grades and on the testing, than they do, as was said before, in the classroom with actual instruction. They spend a lot of time collecting information and entering information into a system. and that's time away from the classroom. So
my school district and many school districts have had to hire extra IT personnel specifically for uploading student data to Harrisburg.
Great. Well, Dawn, I'm going to have to let you go.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks for being on the program. You brought a lot of things into the discussion that we're having here. Now, Lisa, one thing that comes to mind, and I'll bring in Ted Clatter just a second. What comes to mind, what about teachers' union in this thing?
I guess I'm not real familiar with the teacher. I know the teachers' union supports the teachers. I know that there's a lot of concern about the testing and how it's tied to their, their grading or their evaluations.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really familiar with that as far as what they. I know that there was a problem in New York. I know that some of the the union spoke out, but I'm not sure about Pennsylvania.
Right. Well, perhaps Dr. Ted Clatter, Executive Director of the Keystone Christian Education Association, who's joining us here in studio, can help us out on that. Welcome to the program, Ted.
Well, thank you, Bruce.
If you can kind of pick up on the conversation we're having right now with Lisa, we mentioned about the teachers' union and the involvement there. Anything legislation-wise you want to start in on?
Well, the whole issue of legislation at Harrisburg gets to be very complex, interrelated. Maybe I ought to give an overview first, Bruce. There are probably four different types of legislation that have been out there, House or Senate. Number one, you do have a couple bills that have been introduced to just whack Common Core and say, terrible, horrible, no good, very bad, we don't want it. To give an answer as to where that has gone, basically that mentality, that effort has died. There is no real movement in the legislature to ban it, to get rid of it, to excise ourselves out of the quagmire. And then obviously we can talk there as to the what and the why, but bottom line is I do not see across the state any grassroots movement to propel this idea to the fore, and the legislature, very frankly, responds to constituent pressures. If anybody wants to move their legislator, a common rule of thumb is 4 very articulate visits in an office and 10 very articulate letters from constituents can basically change any legislator on the issue that's before.
Lisa, your input on that.
I agree that it does have some input. I don't know how much because I think the legislators actually listen a lot to the money, and I think that you're battling that. So I agree that we need to speak out. I mean, I said that earlier. I mean, all parents need to speak out. I think there's a loud voice in Pennsylvania if they speak out. I also want to point out that Common Core is just another fix, along with Race to the Top and No Child Left Behind.
Yeah.
And if we really want to fix education in our country, we need to go back to what worked before then, where they actually build on a foundation instead of a lot of convoluted ideas and methodologies that have been implemented over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, and it actually sounds like what you're describing is the fact you've got a hole in your wall, so you're going to fix it by opening the hole even larger. Ted, your thoughts on that one?
It is very true. And if I come back just even to that specific question of how do the unions interface with this, in general, the school board establishment, now that's whether the unions, the administrators, the this and the that, they are looking for, I'd almost say, an easy out. If you'll tell them specifically what it takes to gain more money and the pleasure of decision makers, if you'll spell it out, they will be very glad to match the dots to give you what you want. And that's part of where testing, teaching to the test comes in, that if they know exactly the questions that will be asked of the kids, they'll be glad to prepare the kids for those exact questions.
Lisa, give you a couple, final thoughts and words before we have to let you go.
Okay. I just want to encourage parents that are listening to start paying attention, to speak out. I would love for superintendents across the state to gather the thoughts together and to start speaking in Harrisburg with one voice. There's 500 superintendents.
Yeah.
Teachers, be bold, speak out. And just remember that someone needs to start speaking up for the kids. We need some adults in the room to start speaking up for the kids. And it starts with the parents, and it starts with the teachers. I'm only one board member, and I can only do so much. And I appreciate you having me on.
And you are doing wonderful work. I mean, like I said, the article that you wrote is just fantastic. It nails on all the points there. I don't see how anybody could put an argument up against what you wrote. It was just a fantastic thing, and I'd like to thank you for being on the program. And you've been listening to Lisa Esler, Penn Delco board members.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us.
Okay,
now, Ted, continue a little bit more on with the legislation and what you were talking about.
Well, there's a couple other types of legislation that's come through. You've got a senator in this particular quadrant of the state that has introduced a bill against Common Core. But I think you need to realize that their reasons for being against it are maybe quite different, Bruce, from what you're hearing from your different experts today. There is a Senate bill that's been vetted. It has been public news conferences to get rid of Common Core because the poorer children, the poorer school districts, can't achieve as well, so the state must give more money so that all of the children and all of the school districts have an equal opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So that is against Common Core, but it's against Common Core for a very different reason. You also have a legislation that has come through to basically give guidance to the state board and the State Department of Ed that basically says we don't like this Common Core because we think it's going to reduce the standards. So therefore, we, the legislature, ask you all to have higher standards than Common Core. And I think I'd have to say that that has been kind of the political softball that the average legislator hides behind is that, Pennsylvania doesn't have Common Core, and I have heard that so many times.
Yeah.
Now, we don't have Common Core. We have Pennsylvania standards, and our standards are so much higher. But if you go down through all of the different problems that are inherent with Common Core, are also true of other systems, whether it's teaching to the test or money or curtailing everybody's creativity,
mm-hmm.
that everything has to be one way with all of these assessments.
Right.
So whether it is an apple or an apple or an apple, it's the same. And the legislation like this basically gives people something to hide behind when constituents start contacting them. Oh, but we don't have Common Core.
Yeah, well, I like your analogy there with the apple because it sounds to me like the apple might be rotten to the core. But let's get a little perception practice in with the wall of separation in the public school and classroom with Dr. Patricia Tinkey, Associate Professor, Center of Vision and Value, Grove City College. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. As you said, my name is Patricia Tinkey. I teach in both the Spanish and the Education departments here at Grove City College. And in case any of your listeners have to sign off, what the information I'm going to be sharing is available as a free white paper at our website, www.faithandfreedom.com, so that everybody can be aware of what is going on regarding the wall separation in the public school classroom.
Well, for our listeners, if you could explain that wall separation and maybe also throw in a little bit your center of vision and values, what you're all about.
Yes, absolutely. The concept of separation of church and state has first been credited to Thomas Jefferson back in 1802. Because the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution stated Congress would make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, Jefferson declared that this built a wall of separation between the church and state. The problem has been in recent decades that this has been misinterpreted, and some have created what's been called the naked public school concept, or even completely excluding the practice and any study of religion in the public school completely. I'm going to be sharing probably two areas here. One would be what the tests are that the Supreme Court uses to make a decision on whether something can be done in public schools, then also what is actually permitted by teachers, administrators, and students in the public school. First of all, the Establishment Clause says that there is a difference between government speech, which is the school, endorsing religion, and private speech, the student, endorsing religion, which the Free Speech and Free Exercise Clauses protect. The Supreme Court does use several tests for applying the Establishment Clause. One is that students may express religious views in a classroom or a school event as long as three things. They don't ask the audience to participate in a religious activity. They don't use the opportunity to deliver a proselytizing sermon. And they don't give the impression that their views are supported by or endorsed by the school. The Supreme Court also uses the Sherbert test from 1963. For the individual, the court must first determine whether the person, the student, has a claim involving a sincere religious belief. And this is simply the student or the parent saying that they have this religious belief. They do not actually have to prove anything additional. And then the government or the school must prove that it is acting in furtherance of a compelling state interest and that it has pursued that interest in the manner least restrictive or least burdensome to religion. So some of the things that can be done in the public school, for example, besides teaching about religion in an objective manner, teachers may bring in guest speakers, use religious symbols as supplemental resources, and teach about religious holidays without celebrating the latter. And if you go to my white paper on our website, faithandfreedom.com, you will see the list of the court cases that support each of these decisions, as well as a survey that I gave to our education majors to see what they did or did not know about what teachers and students are able to do in public schools. Teachers may have students sing religious songs appropriate to the subject or holiday under study, as long as secular songs are also sung. In addition, teachers may wear jewelry bearing religious symbols, such as a cross, answer student questions about the religious beliefs with a brief statement about their personal faith, and pray audibly and engage in other religious activities outside of the presence of students. Teachers may also be sponsors of student religious clubs in a non-participatory capacity and lead and participate in religious non-school-related activities outside of the school day. At the same time, students have rights. The students have the right to freely exercise their faith, to pray silently anytime, and to pray audibly during non-instructional time, such as in the hallways and cafeteria, and at graduation and sporting events. They also may speak publicly about their faith in and out of the classroom. They may distribute religious literature. They may hold religious events, form religious study groups, student groups, and enjoy equal access to school facilities and funding. Students may initiate or lead prayer as long as they do not use sectarian or proselytizing language. Similarly, the First Amendment does not prohibit valedictorians and salutatorians from including references to God as they relate to their own beliefs in their speeches in a non-proselytizing manner. Therefore, students may share how their faith has impacted their lives without fear of censorship by school officials. At the same time, teachers are school employees, and they are limited in their ability to exercise their faith at school because they are representatives of their school district. Teachers may not evangelize, extend invitations to religious activities, or pray with or in the presence of students. Teachers may not open the school day or a class with prayer or with a Bible reading. Also, teachers may not require students to participate in the Pledge of Allegiance by word or act, nor require students to study curriculum that violates their religious beliefs. Teachers may not discourage or prohibit students from exercising their religious beliefs in their oral or written assignments. And teachers and coaches may participate in community-sponsored events, such as See You at the Pole and Fields of Faith, if they attend before or after their contracted work times and clearly indicate that they are participating in their private capacities as citizens and not in their official capacity as representatives of the school. Consequently, educators can embrace teaching about religion, they can allow students to exercise their faith, and they can guard their own speech so that the school won't appear to be endorsing their religious views. There are several nonprofit organizations that have gone to court to defend teachers and students' rights, and I encourage you to Google these and look up their the court cases that they have defended. These would be the Alliance Defending Freedom, the American Center for Law and Justice, and the Liberty Institute. A superb document that's been written by the First Amendment Center called Finding Common Ground is free, available for download at their website. It is a 16-chapter, 200-plus page document that specifically tells what the rights of teachers, students, administrators are in public schools. Regarding our organization, the Center for Visions and Values, we promote faith and freedom, not just here at Grove City College, but also in all types of areas, not limited just to education, but in every arena.
Dr. Patricia Tinkey, I'm going to have to cut you off there. We do have to head to a commercial break, but we thank you so much for being on our program today with our Education Roundtable. It's really important. That website, one more time, if people want to find out more information. I know you gave that in the beginning.
Yes, www.faithandfreedom.com.
Okay, thank great. You. Thank you so much. All right, like I said, we do have to head to a commercial break. You've been listening to an exclusive day here on It's a New Day. We're talking all things education, and in our second hour, we have more great people, experts giving their facts, what you need to know about education and what you can do. And I want to remind our listeners, those just tuning in now, this will be up as a podcast on our website, 1180wfyl.com. Go check that out later today. And as always, you can contact us with any information about education that you think is important. Email us, info@1180wfyl.com. We're heading to a commercial break, but we'll be back at 8 o'clock. Stay tuned.